means understanding her, then understanding her must include understanding why she is a drinker. You run through all her prehistory, and recent history, and current situation, and possible future. You understand all this, and before you know where you are, you have passed somehow from total denial of the fact that she drinks to total comprehension of why she might do so. But with this comes a brute chronological fact. As far as you know, Susan only drank occasionally in all her years with MacLeod, but now that she is living with you, she is, has become, is still becoming, an alcoholic. There is too much in this for you to entirely acknowledge, let alone bear. She is sitting up in her quilted bed jacket, the newspapers around her, at her elbow a mug of coffee, long gone cold. She has a frown on her, and her chin is pushed forward as if she has been ruminating all day. It is now 6 in the evening, and you are in your last year of law studies. You sit on the side of her bed.
"Casey Paul?"
she begins in an affectionate, puzzled tone.
"I've decided that there's something seriously wrong."
"I think you may be right," you answer quietly. At last, you think, perhaps this is the moment of breakthrough. That's what's meant to happen, isn't it? Everything comes to a moment of crisis, and then the fever breaks, and all becomes clear and rational and happy again.
"But I've been searching my wits all day, and I can't get a handle on it."
"Now where do you go? Do you start straight in again with the drinking? Suggest seeing a doctor again, a specialist, a psychiatrist? You are 25 and quite untrained for this kind of situation." There are no articles in the newspaper headed, "How to Cope with Your Middle-Aged Female Alcoholic Lover." You are on your own. You have no theories of life yet. You only know some of its pleasures and pains. You still believe, however, in love, and in what love can do, how it can transform a life, indeed the lives of two people. You believe in its invulnerability, its tenacity, its ability to outrun any opponent. This, in fact, is your only theory of life so far. So you do the best you can. You take one of her wrists and talk about how you met and fell in love. How you were chosen by lot and then threw in your lot together. How you had run away in the finest tradition of lovers. And you continue like this, meaning and believing every word. And then you gently suggest that she's been drinking a little too much lately.
"Oh, you're always going on about that,"
she replies, as if this was some tedious and pedantic obsession of yours, nothing really to do with her.
"But if you want me to say so, then I will. Maybe I occasionally take a drop or two more than is good for me."
You quell the prompting inner voice which says, "No, not a drop or two, a whole bottle or two more than is good for you." She goes on.
"I'm talking about something much bigger than that. I think there's something seriously wrong."
"You mean something that causes your drinking? Something I don't know about?" Your mind heads towards some terrible, defining event in her childhood, much worse than a party kiss from Uncle Humph.
"Oh, you really can be a great bore at times," she says mockingly. "No, much more important than that. What's behind it all?"
You are already losing a little patience. "And what do you think might be behind it all?"
"Maybe it's the Ruskies."
"The Ruskies?" You yelp.
"Oh, Paul, do try and keep up. I don't mean the actual Ruskies. They're just a figure of speech."
"Like, say, the Ku Klux Klan, or the KGB, or the CIA, or Che Guevara." You suspect that this one brief chance is slipping away, and you don't know if it is your fault, her fault, or nobody's fault. "Okay," you say. "The Russians are a figure of speech." But she takes this only as sly impertinence.
"It's no good if you can't follow. There's something behind it all, just out of sight. Something which holds it all together. Something that, if we put it back together, would mend it all. Would mend us all. Don't you see?
You give it your best shot.
You mean like Buddhism? Oh, don't be absurd. You know what I think about religion. Well, it was just an idea,
you say jokingly.
And not a very good one.
How quickly it has gone from something tentative and gentle and hopeful to something irascible and mocking. And how far away from what you consider to be the problem, not just behind it all, but on the surface and at all points in between. The bottles under the sink, under the bed, behind the bookshelves, in her stomach, in her head, in her heart. It may be true that you don't know the cause, if indeed there is a single, identifiable cause. But it seems to you that you can only work with, against, the manifestations that erupt every day. You know what she means about religion, of course. There is her adamantine disapproval of missionaries, whether they seek to convert in distant lands or on suburban doorsteps. And there is also the Malta story, which she has told you more than once. When the girls were small, Gordon MacLeod was posted to Malta for a couple of years. She went out and lived there for some of the time, and her abiding memory was of the priest's bicycle. Yes, she would explain, it's terribly Catholic out there. The church is all-powerful and everyone's very obedient, and the church keeps them down by making the women have as many children as possible. It's absolutely impossible to obtain birth control on the island. They're very backward in that regard. John Bell and Croydon would be run out of town, so you have to take the equipment out with you. Anyway, she goes on, it sometimes happens that a young bride doesn't get pregnant immediately after marriage, say for a year or two, despite all her prayers. Or maybe there's a woman who has two children and desperately wants a third, but it isn't happening. And in such cases, the priest will come round and prop his bicycle outside the front door so everyone, especially the husband, knows not to interfere until the bicycle has gone. And when, 9 months later, though of course it may take several goes, the family is blessed, that blessing is known as the priest's child, and thought of as a gift from God. And sometimes there is more than one priest's child in the family. Can you imagine that, Paul? Don't you think it's barbaric? You do think it's barbaric. You say so every time. And now part of you, the doomful, despairing, sarcastic part of you, wonders whether, if it isn't the Ruskies who are behind it all, then it might be the Vatican. You still share a bed, but haven't made love for a long time now. You don't ask yourself how long in calendar terms, because what counts is how it feels in terms of the heart. You discover more about sex than you want to, or more than you should be allowed to discover while still young. Certain discoveries should be kept for later in life, when they might hurt less. You know already that there is good sex and bad sex. Naturally, you prefer good sex to bad sex, but also, being young, you think that even so, all things considered, taking the rough with the smooth, bad sex is better than no sex at all. And sometimes better than masturbation, though sometimes not. But if you think these are the only categories of sex that exist, you find you are mistaken. Because there is a category which you had not known to exist. Something which isn't, as you might have guessed had you heard about it before, merely a subcategory of bad sex. And that is sad sex. Sad sex is the saddest sex of all. Sad sex is when, the toothpaste in her mouth not fully disguising the smell of sweet sherry, she whispers, "Cheer me up, Casey Paul." And you oblige. Though cheering her up also involves cheering yourself down. Sad sex is when she is already doped up by a cheering up pill, but you think that if you fuck her, it might cheer her up a bit more. Sad sex is when you are yourself in such despair, the situation so insoluble, the prehistory so oppressive, the very balance of your soul in doubt from day to day, moment to moment, that you think you may as well forget yourself for a few minutes, for half an hour, in sex. But you don't forget yourself, or your state of soul, not even for a nanosecond. Sad sex
is when you feel you are losing all touch with her, and she with you. But this is a way of telling one another that the connection is still there, somehow. That neither of you is giving up on the other, even if part of you fears that you should. Then you discover that insisting on the connection is the same as prolonging the pain. Sad sex is when you are making love to a woman while thinking about how to kill her husband, even if this is something you would never be able to do because you are not that sort of person. But as your body continues, so does your mind. You find yourself thinking, yes. If you discovered him in the process of strangling her, you can imagine hitting him on the back of the head with a spade, or maybe stabbing him with a kitchen knife, though you realize that, given your hopelessness at fisticuffs, you might end up with the spade or the knife skidding off him and striking her instead. Then this parallel narrative in your head gets even madder, proposing that if you were to miss him and hit her instead, then it might be that you secretly wanted to harm her, because she, this woman now naked beneath you, has got you into this insoluble morass so early in your life. Sad sex is when she is sober. You both desire one another. You know that you will always love her regardless, just as she will always love you regardless. But you, both of you perhaps, now realize that loving one another does not necessarily lead to happiness. And so your lovemaking has become less a search for consolation than a hopeless attempt to deny your mutual unhappiness. Good sex is better than bad sex. Bad sex is better than no sex, except when no sex is better than bad sex. Self-sex is better than no sex, except when no sex is better than self-sex. Sad sex is always far worse than good sex, bad sex, self-sex, and no sex. Sad sex is the saddest sex of all. At college, you meet Paula, blonde, friendly, discreet, who has switched to law after a short service commission in the army. You like her handwriting when she shows you a case summary from a lecture you missed. You invite her for coffee one morning, then start having sandwich lunches in the nearby public gardens. One evening, you take her to the cinema and kiss her goodnight. You exchange phone numbers. A few days later, she asks, "Who's that mad woman who lives in your house?" "I'm sorry." Already there is a chill spreading through you. "I rang you up last night. A woman answered the phone." "That would have been my landlady. She sounded mad as a hatter." You take a breath. "She's a little eccentric," you say. You want this conversation to stop immediately. You wish it had never started. You wish Paula had never phoned the number you gave her. You very much don't want her to be specific, but you know she is going to be. "I asked when you'd be back, and she said, 'Oh, he's very much the dirty stop-out, that young man. You can't rely on him from one moment to the next.' And then she came over all genteel and said something like, 'If you will excuse me while I fetch a pencil, I shall pass on any message you may choose to leave.' Well, I put the phone down before she came back." She is looking at you expectantly, sure that you will provide her with an explanation that will satisfy her. It doesn't have to be much. A joke might even do it. Various extravagant lies cross your mind until, preferring the quarter truth to the self-interested obfuscation, and also feeling stubborn and defensive about Susan, you repeat, "She's a little eccentric." And that, unsurprisingly, is the end of your relationship with Paula. And you realize that such a pattern is likely to repeat itself with other friendly and direct girls whose handwriting you admire. Around this time, you stop thinking of her family by their nicknames. All that Mr. Elephant Pants and Miss Grumpy stuff was fine and funny at the time, part of the first silliness and proprietariness of love. But it was also a facetious minimizing of their presence in her life. And if you were beginning to think of yourself as grown-up, however forcedly and prematurely, then they should be allowed their own maturity as well. Another thing you notice is that you no longer fall easily into the private, teasing love language that used to pass between you. Perhaps the weight of what you have taken on has temporarily crushed out love's decorativeness. Of course, you still love her, and tell her so, but in plainer terms nowadays. Perhaps when you have solved her, or she has solved herself, there will be room again for such playfulness. You can't be sure. Susan, however, continues using all the little phrases from her side of the relationship. It is her way of maintaining that nothing has changed, that she is fine, you are fine, all is fine. But she, you, and it aren't. And those familiar words sometimes cause a prickle of embarrassment, more often lurching pain. You let yourself into the house, deliberately making enough noise to alert her, and as you come down the short flight of stairs into the kitchen, you find her in a familiar pose, red-faced by the gas fire, wrinkling her brow at a newspaper as if the world really does need to sort itself out. Then she looks up brightly and says, "Where have you been all my life?" Or, "Here's the dirty stuff out." And your cheerfulness, even if briefly assumed, drains like bathwater. You look around and take stock of the situation. You open the store cupboards to see if there is something you can make into something, and she lets you get on with it, while offering occasional remarks designed to convey that she is still well capable of understanding a newspaper.
"Things seem to be in a frightful mess. Don't you agree, Casey Paul?"
And you ask, "Where exactly are we talking about?" And she replies,
"Oh, just about everywhere."
At which point, you might throw the emptied tin of plum tomatoes into the bin with some force, and she will chide you.
"Temper, temper, Casey Paul."
By months of manoeuvring, you get her first to a GP, then to a consultant psychiatrist at the local hospital. She doesn't want you to come with her, but you insist, knowing what will probably happen otherwise. You turn up at 2:45 for a 3 o'clock slot. The waiting area already contains a dozen other patients, and you realize it is the hospital's policy to book everyone in for the same time, which is when the consultant's session begins. You can see their point. Mad people, and at your age you use the term pretty broadly, are presumably not among the world's most punctilious timekeepers, so it's best to summon them all on block. She makes what might be an attempt to escape, heading off to the ladies. You let her go with a 50-50 expectation that she won't return, but she does, and you find yourself reflecting cynically that she probably went to the hospital shop to check if they stocked booze, or maybe asked a few nurses where the bar was, only to receive the annoying news that the hospital doesn't have one. You realize how sympathy and antagonism can coexist. You are discovering how many seemingly incompatible emotions can thrive, side by side, in the same human heart. You are angry with the books you have read, none of which have prepared you for this. No doubt you are reading the wrong books, or reading them in the wrong way. You feel, even at this late, desperate stage, that your emotional situation is still more interesting than that of your friends. They, mostly, have girlfriends and mostly have peer sex. Some have been inspected by their girlfriends' parents, receiving approval, disapproval, or judgment suspended. Most have a plan for their future life, which includes this girlfriend, or if not, one very similar. A plan to become furrow dwellers. But for the moment, they have only the traditional clear-skinned joys, sane dreams, and incoherent frustrations of young men in their mid-twenties with girlfriends of the same age. Yet here you are, in a hospital waiting area, surrounded by mad people, in love with a woman who is being categorized as potentially mad. And the strange thing is, part of you feels exhilarated by it. You think, not only do you love Susan more than they love their girlfriends, you must do, otherwise you wouldn't be sitting here among all the nutters, but you are having a more interesting life. They may measure their girlfriends' brains and breasts and their future parents-in-law's deposit accounts, and imagine they have won. But you are still ahead of them because your relationship is more fascinating, more complicated, and more insoluble. And the proof of this is that you are sitting here on a metal-stacking chair, half-reading some discarded magazine, while your beloved dreams of, what? Escape? No doubt. Escape from here. Escape from you. Escape from life. She, too, is staggering beneath the weight of extreme, unbearable and incompatible emotions. You are both in deep pain. And yet, aware as you are of the stupid, bollocksy world of male competitiveness, you tell yourself that you are still a winner. And when you get to this point in your thoughts, the next logical stage is this. You're a nutter as well. You are obviously one stark, staring, complete and utter nutter. On the other hand, you are the youngest fucking nutter in the whole waiting area. So you have won again. Former under-12, under-6-stone school boxing champion becomes hospital's under-26 nutter champion. At this moment, a round, bald, suited man opens the door of the consulting room. Mr. Ellis, he calls quietly. There is no reply. Familiar with the inattention, selected deafness, and other failings of his patients, the consultant raises his voice. Mr. Ellis! Some old fool wearing 3 sweaters and an anorak gets to his feet. A toweling headband restrains the 10 or so wisps of white hair that sprawl from his crown. He stands looking round for a moment, as if perhaps expecting applause for having recognized his own name, then follows the consultant into his office. You are not prepared for what happens next. You hear the psychiatrist's voice quite clearly say, "And how are we today, Mr. Ellis?" You look at the closed door. You see that there is a 3-inch gap between the foot of it and the floor. You guess that the consultant must be facing the door. You do not hear a reply from the deaf old fool, but perhaps there hasn't been one, because next, loud enough to rouse the other nodding nutters, come the words, "So, how's the depression, Mr. Ellis?" You are not sure if Susan has been paying attention. For yourself, you think this is unlikely to work. There is her shame, which is ever-present. And then there is your shame, which sometimes presents itself as pride, sometimes as a kind of noble realism, but also, mostly, as what it is. Just shame. You come back one evening to find her pie-eyed in a chair, the water glass by her side still containing a good inch or so of non-water. You decide to behave as if this is all completely normal, indeed what domestic life is all about. You go into the kitchen and start looking around for something to turn into something. You find some eggs. You ask if she would like an omelette.
"It's easy for you," she answers belligerently.
"What's easy for me?"
"That's a clever lawyer's answer,"
she replies, taking a swig right in front of you, which she rarely does. You are about to go back to cracking eggs when she adds,
"Gerald died today."
"Which Gerald?" You can't immediately think of a Gerald among your mutual friends.
"Which Gerald indeed? Mr. Clever, my Gerald, my Gerald that I told you about, the one I was engaged to. This was the day he died."
You feel terrible. Not because you have forgotten the date, she has never told you it before, but because, unlike you, she has her dead to remember. Her fiancé, the brother who disappeared out over the Atlantic, Gordon's father, whose name you no longer remember, who had been soft on her. You have no such figures in your life. No griefs, no holes, no losses. So you don't know what it's like. Everyone should remember their dead, you believe, and everyone else should respect this need and desire. You are, in fact, rather envious, and wish you had a few dead of your own. Later, you become more suspicious. She has never mentioned the day of Gerald's death before, and there is no way for you to check. Just as, in happier days, there was no way for you to check when she told you how many times the two of you had made love. Perhaps when she heard your key turn in the lock, and she was unable to get up and also unwilling to hide the glass at her elbow, she decided... No, this is perhaps too deliberate a verb to describe her mental processes that evening. She realized, yes, she suddenly realized that it was the day of Gerald's death, though it could equally have been Alex or that of Gordon's father. Who could tell? Who knew? And who in the end cared? I said I never kept a diary. This isn't strictly true. There was a point, in my isolation and turmoil, when I thought writing things down might help. I used a hardback notebook, black ink, one side of the paper. I tried to be objective. There was no point, I thought, in merely venting my feelings of hurt and betrayal. I remember that the first line I wrote down was, "All alcoholics are liars." This was obviously not based on a huge sample or broad research, but I believed it at the time. And now, decades later, with more field experience, I believe it to be an essential truth about the condition. I went on, "All lovers are truth-tellers." Again, the sample was small, consisting mainly of myself. It seemed to me evident that love and truth were connected. Indeed, as I may have said, that to live in love is to live in truth. And then the conclusion to this quasi-syllogism. Therefore, the alcoholic is the opposite of the lover. This seemed not just logical, but also consistent with my observations. Nowadays, a lifetime later, the second of these propositions seems the weakest. I have seen too many examples of lovers who, far from living in truth, dwelt in some fantasy land where self-delusion and self-aggrandizement reigned, with reality nowhere to be found. Yet, even while I was compiling my notebook, searching to be objective, the subjective kept undermining me. For instance, I realized, looking back at our time in the village, that whereas I thought of myself as both lover and truth-teller, the truths I had told were only to myself and Susan. I told lies to my parents, to Susan's family, to my own close friends. I even dissembled at the tennis club. I protected the zone of truth with a rampart of lies, just as she was now lying to me all the time about her drinking, as well as lying to herself. And yet she would still affirm that she loved me. So I began to suspect that I was wrong in considering alcoholism as the opposite of love. Perhaps they were much closer than I imagined. Alcoholism is certainly just as obsessive, as absolutist as love. And maybe to the drinker, the hit of booze is as powerful as the hit of sex is to the lover. So could the alcoholic be merely a lover who has shifted the object and focus of his or her, no, her, love? My observations and reflections had filled a few dozen pages when I came home one evening to find Susan in a state I knew all too well. Red-faced, semi-coherent, quick to take offense, yet at the same time genteelly pretending that all was for the best in this best possible of worlds. I went to my room and discovered that my desk had been inexpertly rifled. I had, even then, a habit of orderliness, and knew what lived where. Since the desk contained my notes on alcoholism, I assumed, wearily, that she had probably read them. Still, I thought, perhaps in the long run the shock might have a useful effect on her. In the short run, evidently not. The next time I went to my notebook to make an addition, I saw that Susan had done more than just read it. She had left an annotation beneath my last entry using the same black ink from the same pen. In an unsteady hand, she had written, "With your inky pen to make you hate me." I didn't accuse her of rifling my desk, reading my notebook, writing in it. I could imagine her saying, in a tone of polite protest, "No, I don't think so." I was weary of constant confrontation. But then, I was equally weary of a constant pretense that all was well, a constant evasion of the truth. I also realized that it would be impossible for me to write anything down in the future without picturing her at my desk studying my latest denunciations. This would be intolerable for both of us. The annotation of pain on my part, the dim yet irate acknowledgement of pain caused on her part, so I threw away the notebook. But that half-formed sentence of hers, written by a wonky hand with an unfamiliar pen, remained with me, and always has. Not least because of its ambiguity. Did she mean, "You use your inky pen to write down things which will then make you hate me"? Or did she mean, "I have left my mark with your inky pen because I want to make you hate me"? Critical and aggressive, or masochistic and self-pitying? Maybe she knew what she meant when she wrote the words, but there was no subsequent clarity to be found. You may judge the second interpretation over-subtle and designed to let me off the hook, but, and this formed the basis of another of my long-lost notes, the alcoholic, in my experience, wants to provoke, to push away help, to justify her own isolation. So if she managed to convince herself that I hated her, all the more reason to turn for comfort to the bottle. You are taking her somewhere in the car. There is no need for her to fear the journey, and you will pick her up later and drive her home. But there are the usual delays before you can get her into the car. And as you are about to release the handbrake, she rushes back into the house and returns with a large, bright, yellow plastic laundry bag, which she puts between her feet. She does not explain. You do not ask. This is where things have got to. And then you think, oh, fuck it. What's that for? You ask.
The thing is, she replies, I'm not feeling entirely well, and it's just possible I might be sick, what with the car and all that.
No, you think, what with being drunk and all that. A doctor friend has told you that alcoholics sometimes throw up so violently that they can perforate their own esophagus. As it happens, she doesn't need to vomit, but she might as well have done, because she has already filled your head with an image of her throwing up into this yellow bag, and you cannot stop seeing it. You might as well have listened to her dry retching and then wet retching, and can hear the vomit trickling into the bright yellow plastic. The smell, too, of course, in your small car. The excuses, the lies, her lies, your lies. Because it is no longer just a question of her lying to you. When she does so, you have two choices. Call her out on it, or accept what she says. Usually, out of weariness and a desire for peace, and yes, out of love, you accept what she says. You condone the lie, and so become a liar by proxy. And it is a very short step from accepting her lies to lying yourself, out of weariness and a desire for peace, and also out of love. Yes, that too. What a long way you have come. Years ago, when you started off lying to your parents, you did so with a kind of relish, reckless of consequence. It almost felt character building. Later, you began to tell lies in all directions to protect her and to protect your love. Later still, she starts lying to you, to keep you from knowing her secret, and now she lies with a kind of relish, reckless of consequence. Then, finally, you begin lying to her. Why? Something to do with the need to create some internal space which you could keep intact, and where you could yourself remain intact. And this is how it is for you now. Love and truth, where have they gone? You ask yourself, is staying with her an act of courage on your part or an act of cowardice? Perhaps both. Or is it just an inevitability? She has taken to going to the village by train. You approve. You think this comes from a recognition of her unfitness to drive. You take her to the station. She tells you the time of her return train, though, often as not, she doesn't turn up until the next one, or the one after. And when she says, "Don't bother meeting me," she is protecting her inner world. And when you reply, "Fine, sure you'll be all right," you are protecting yours. The phone goes one evening. Is that Henry? No, sorry, wrong number. You are about to put the phone down when the man reads your number to you.
Yes, that's right.
Well, good evening, sir. This is the transport police at Waterloo Station. We have a lady here in a slightly distressed condition. We found her asleep in the train and, well, her handbag was open and there was a sum of money in it, so, you see...
Yes, I see.
She showed us this number and asked us to call Henry.
In the background, you hear her voice.
Call Henry! Call Henry!
Ah, her shorthand for Henry Road.
So you drive to Waterloo, find the office of the railway police, and there she is, sitting up, bright-eyed, waiting to be collected, knowing that it would happen. The two policemen are courteous and concerned. They are doubtless used to helping drunk old ladies found snoring in empty carriages. Not that she is old, just that when she is drunk, you think of her, suddenly, as a drunk old lady.
Well, thank you very much for looking after her.
Ah, she was no trouble at all, sir. Quiet as a mouse. Look after yourself, madam.
She gives them a rather stately, acknowledging nod. You take the arm of this piece of left luggage and off you go. Your annoyance and despair, however, are cut by a certain pride in her having been no trouble. Though what if she had been? Eventually, more out of despair than hope, you try tough love, or at least what your understanding of that concept is. You don't let her get away with anything. You call her out on her lies. You pour away whatever bottles you find, some in obvious places, some in such strange locations that she must have hidden them there while drunk, and then forgotten where she had put them. You get her banned from the three local shops which sell alcohol. You give them each a photo to keep behind the till. You do not tell her this. You think the humiliation of being refused service will jolt her. You never find out, and she merely gets round the obstruction by travelling further afield. You hear reports. Some people are shy about mentioning things to you, others not. A friend on a bus a mile or so away from Henry Road has spotted her down an alleyway next to an off-licence, raising a newly bought bottle to her lips. This image burns deep, and transforms itself from another's account into your own private memory. A neighbour tells you that your auntie was in the Cap and Bells last Saturday night, downing five sherries in succession until they stopped serving her.
It's not the kind of pub someone like her should be in,
the neighbour adds concernedly. They get all sorts in there. You picture the scene, from her ashamed first order at the bar to her unsteady walk home, and this too becomes part of your memory bank. You tell her that her behaviour is destroying your love for her. You do not mention hers for you.
Then you must leave me,
she says. She is flushed, dignified and logical. You know that you are not going to do this. The question is whether or not she knows it too. You write her a letter. If spoken words of rebuke fly unhindered straight out of her head, perhaps written ones will stick. You tell her that the way she is going, she will almost certainly die of a wet brain, that there is nothing more you can do for her, except come to her funeral, whenever that might be. You leave the letter on the kitchen table in an envelope with her name on it. She never mentions receiving it, opening it, reading it.
With your inky pen to make you hate me.
You realize that tough love is also tough on the lover. You are taking her to Gatwick. Martha has invited her out to Brussels, where she is working as a Eurocrat. To your surprise, Susan agrees. You promise to make it as easy as possible for her. You will drive her to the airport and see her through check-in. She nods, then says straightforwardly,
You might have to let me have a drink before getting on the plane. Belgian courage.
You are more than relieved. Almost encouraged. The night before, she is half-packed and half-drunk. You go to bed. She continues packing and drinking. The next morning, she comes to you with a cupped hand over her mouth.
I'm afraid I don't think I shall be able to go.
You look at her without speaking.
I've lost my teeth. I can't find them anywhere. I think I may have thrown them into the garden.
You don't say anything except, we have to leave by 2. You decide to let her go on destroying her life. But perhaps your failure to respond, to offer neither help nor rebuke, is for once the correct approach. An hour or two later, she is walking around with her teeth in, never alluding to either having lost them or found them. At 2 o'clock, you put her case in the back of the car, double-check her ticket and passport, and set off. There have been no last-minute diversions, no scurrying for a bright yellow laundry bag. She sits beside you, quiet as a mouse, in the railway policeman's words. As you are approaching Redhill, she turns and says in a demurely puzzled way, as if you were more her chauffeur than her lover,
"Would you mind very much telling me where we are going?"
"You're going to Brussels to visit Martha."
"Oh, I don't think so. There must be some mistake."
"That's why you've got your ticket and your passport in your handbag, though they are actually in your pocket, as you don't want them going the way of her teeth."
"But I don't know where she lives."
"She's meeting you at the airport." There is a pause.
"Yes,"
she says, nodding.
"I seem to remember about this now."
There is no further resistance. Part of you thinks she should have a large label around her neck with her name and destination written on it, like a wartime refugee, with perhaps her gas mask in a box as well. At the bar, you buy her a double schooner of sherry, which she sips with inattentive gentility. You think it could be worse. This is how you react to situations nowadays. You have the lowest of expectations. The trip turns out to be a success. She has been shown the city and brings you some postcards. Miss Grumpy, she announces, is nowadays much less so, perhaps influenced by a charming Belgian boyfriend who was in attendance. Her memories are clearer than usual, a sign that she has been temperate. You feel happy for her, if slightly resentful that she can clean up her act for others more easily than for you, or so it seems. But then, she tells you that on the last morning, the real reason why her daughter invited her out became clear. She, Miss Grumpy, is of the opinion that her mother ought to go back to Mr. Gordon MacLeod, who is now very contrite and promises to be on his best behaviour if she returns. According to Susan. According to her daughter. To save time and to save emotion, you address her, straightforwardly, as a drinker. No longer, "There seems to be a problem. Do you know what it might be? Perhaps I can suggest." None of that. So one day, you suggest Alcoholics Anonymous, not knowing if there is a branch near you. "Not going to the God-botherers," she replies firmly. Given her dislike of priests and extreme disapproval of missionaries, this response is understandable. No doubt she thinks of AA as yet another bunch of American missionaries interfering in other countries' belief systems, bringing the foreign halt and lame into the radiant presence of their God. You do not blame her. Mostly, you can only deal with the day-to-day crises. Occasionally, you look to the future, and find one outcome which has a terrifying logic. It goes like this. She doesn't drink all the time. Not every day. She can go a day or two without the comfort of a bottle. But her memory, as a result of the drink, is getting poorer. So the logic runs, if she carries on destroying her memory at the present rate, maybe she will reach the stage when she has actually forgotten she is an alcoholic. Might that happen? It would be one way to cure her. But you also think, you might as well simply blast her with ECT and be done with it. Here is one of the problems. You don't, at bottom, think of alcoholism as a physical disease. You might have heard that it is, but you aren't really convinced. You can't help thinking of it as many people, some of whom you might not want to be associated with, have thought about it for centuries, as a moral disease. And one of the reasons you do so is because she does too. When she is at her most lucid, her most rational,
her most gentle, and as much tormented by what is happening to her as you are, she tells you, as she always has, that she hates the fact she is a drinker, and feels deep shame and guilt about it, so you must leave her, because she is no good. She has a moral disease, which is why hospitals and doctors cannot cure her. They cannot fix a flawed personality from a played-out generation. She urges you again to leave her. But you cannot leave Susan. How could you bear to withdraw your love from her? If you didn't love her, who would? And maybe it's worse than this. It is not just that you love her, but that you are addicted to her. How ironic would that be? An image comes into your head one day, an image of your relationship to one another. You are at an upstairs window of the house on Henry Road. She has somehow climbed out, and you are hanging on to her. By the wrists, of course. And her weight makes it impossible for you to pull her back inside. It is all you can do to stop yourself being pulled out with her, by her. At one point, she opens her mouth to scream, but no sound emerges. Instead, her dental plate comes loose. You hear it hit the ground with a plasticky clatter. You are stuck there, the two of you, locked together, and will remain so until your strength gives out and she falls. It is only a metaphor, or the worst of dreams. Yet there are metaphors which sit more powerfully in the brain than remembered events. Another image, based on a remembered event, comes into your mind. You are back at the village, the two of you, in the flush of love, quietly but entirely intent on one another. She is wearing a print dress, and, knowing that you are watching her, because you are always watching her, she goes over to the chintzy sofa, plumps herself down, and says, "Look, Casey Paul, I'm disappearing. I'm doing my disappearing act." And for a moment, as you look, you can see only her face and the stockinged part of her legs. Now she is doing another disappearing act. Her body is still there, but what lies inside? Her mind, her memory, her heart is slipping away. Her memory is obscured by darkness and untruth, and persuades itself towards coherence only by fabulation. Her mind oscillates between stunned inertia and hysterical volatility. But it is the disappearing act which her heart is doing. Oh, that is the hardest part to bear. It is as if, in her thrashing about, she has stirred up the mud that lies at the bottom of us all. And what is now coming to the surface is unfocused anger and fear and frustration and harshness and selfishness and mistrust. When she tells you solemnly that in her considered opinion your behavior towards her has been not just beastly, but actively criminal, she really thinks it is true. And all the sweetness of her nature, the laughingness and trustingness central to the woman you fell in love with, can no longer be seen. You used to say, when putting off friends who wanted to visit, "Oh, she's having a bad day, she's not herself." And when they saw her drunk, you'd say, "But she's still the same underneath. She's still the same underneath." How many times did you tell this to others, when the person you were actually addressing was yourself? And then comes the day when you no longer believe such words. You no longer believe that she is still the same underneath. You believe that being not herself is her new self. You fear that she is, finally and utterly, doing her disappearing act. But you make one final effort, and she does too. You get her admitted to hospital. Not the National Temperance, as you had hoped, but a general all-female ward. You sit her down on a bench while they are admitting her, and explain gently, once more, how it has come to this, and what they will do for her, and how it will help.
"I'll give it my very best shot, Casey Paul," she says sweetly.
You kiss her on the temple and promise to visit her every day, which you do. At first, they put her to sleep for 3 days, hoping to peaceably flush the alcohol out of her system, while also calming her disturbed brain. You sit by her lightly sleeping form and think that this time, surely, it will work. This time, she is under proper medical supervision. The problem has been stated clearly, even she isn't ducking it, and at last something will be done. You look at her calm face and think of the best years of your time together, and imagine that everything you had back then will now return. On the 4th day, she is still asleep when you go in. You ask to see a doctor, and some 20-year-old houseman with a clipboard presents himself. You ask why she is still sedated.
We woke her up this morning, but she immediately became disruptive.
Disruptive?
Yes. She attacked the nurses.
You don't believe this. You ask him to repeat it. He does.
So we put her under again. Don't worry, it's a very light sedative. I'll show you.
He adjusts the drip slightly. Almost instantly, she begins to stir.
You see?
Then he adjusts the drip again and sends her back to sleep. You find this deeply sinister. You have yielded her care to the authority of some youthful technocrat who has never met her.
You're her godson,
you reply automatically. Or maybe you say nephew, or possibly lodger, which at least contains 4 correct letters in it.
Well, if we wake her up and she's that disruptive again, we'll have to section her.
Section her? You are horrified.
But she's not mad. She's an alcoholic. She needs treatment.
So do all the other patients. And they need the nurse's attention. We can't have the nurses being attacked. You still don't believe his initial allegation.
But you can't just section her by yourself.
You're right, there have to be 2 signatures, but it's just a formality in cases like this. You realize you have not brought her to a place of safety after all. You have delivered her over to the kind of zealot who in the old days would have prescribed a straitjacket plus a course of electroconvulsive therapy. Susan would have called him a
little Hitler.
Who knows? Perhaps she did. You partly hope so. You say,
I would like to be there when you next wake her up. I think it would help.
Very well, says the curt young man whom you have already come to hate deeply. But such is the way of hospitals. This arrogant little shit isn't there when you next come, and you never see him again. Instead, a female doctor operates the drip. Slowly, Susan wakes. She looks up, sees you, and smiles.
Where have you been all my life?
She asks.
You dirty stop-out.
The doctor reacts with slight surprise, but you kiss Susan on the forehead, and the 2 of you are left alone together.
So you've come to take me home?
Not just yet, darling, you say. You've got to stay here for a while, until you're cured.
But there's nothing wrong with me. I'm perfectly well and insist on being taken home at once. Take me to Henry.
You grasp both her wrists. You squeeze very hard. You explain that the doctors won't release her until she is cured. You remind her of the promise she made when you brought her here. You say that the last time they brought her round, she attacked the nurses.
No, I don't think so,
she says in her most distant, genteel manner, as if you are some ill-informed peasant. You talk at length to her, asking for her promise to behave until you come back tomorrow, at least until then. She doesn't respond. You press her. Then she promises, but with a stubbornness of tone you are all too familiar with. The next day, you approach the ward expecting the worst, that she's been sedated again, or even sectioned. But she is looking alert, and her colour is good. She greets you rather as if you were her guest. A nurse walks by.
The maids here are frightfully good,
she says, giving a wave to the passing figure. You think, what's the right tactic? Go along with it? Challenge it? You decide that you mustn't indulge her dream world. They're not maids, Susan. They're nurses. You think she might have confused hospital with hotel, which, after all, would not be much of a verbal slippage.
Some of them are,
she agrees. Then, disappointed with your lack of perspicacity, adds,
But most of them are maids.
You let it go.
I've told them all about you,
she says. Your heart sinks, but you let that go as well. The next day, you find her agitated again. She is out of bed, sitting up in a chair. On the tray in front of her are 5 pairs of spectacles and a copy of a P.G. Wodehouse novel she has mysteriously acquired.
Where did you get all those glasses?
Oh, she replies casually.
I don't know where they come from. I expect people have been giving them to me.
She puts on a pair which are evidently not hers and opens the book at random.
He's frightfully funny, isn't he?
You agree. She has always enjoyed Wodehouse, and you take this as a good, if slightly confused, sign. You tell her what's in the newspapers. You mention a postcard you've had from Eric. You say that all is well at Henry Road. She listens idly, then seizes a different pair of glasses, though still not her own, opens the book at random again, and, probably seeing it no more in focus than the previous time, announces,
It's frightful rubbish, this, isn't it?
You think your heart will break. Now. Here. Immediately. The following day, she is again under sedation. The woman in the next bed chats to you and asks what's wrong with your nan. You are so weary of it all that you answer, She's an alcoholic. The woman turns away in distaste. You know exactly what she is thinking. Why give a good hospital bed to a drinker? Furthermore, a female drinker. One thing you have discovered is that male alcoholics are allowed to be amusing, even poignant. Young drinkers of either sex, when out of control, are indulged. But female alcoholics, old enough to know better, old enough to be mothers, even grandmothers, these are the lowest of the low. The next day, she is awake again and refusing to look at you. So you just sit there for a while. You glance at the tray in front of her. This time, her nocturnal ward rambling has netted only 2 pairs of other patients' glasses, plus a tabloid newspaper she would never have in the house.
I do think,
she announces finally,
that you will be remembered as one of the greatest criminals in the history of the world.
You are tempted to agree. Why not? They do not threaten to section her. That little Hitler is off practicing his black arts on other, less disruptive patients. But they tell you that they cannot treat her further, that the rest may have done her some good, that this is not the appropriate place for her and they need to free up the bed. You see their point of view entirely, but ask yourself, then what is the appropriate place for her? Which stands in for a wider question, what is her place in the world? As the two of you leave, the woman in the next bed pointedly ignores you both. It has taken some years for you to realize how much, beneath her laughing irreverence, there lies panic and pandemonium. Which is why she needs you there, fixed and steadfast. You have assumed this role willingly, lovingly. It makes you feel grown up to be a guarantor. It has meant, of course, that for most of your 20s you were obliged to forgo what others of your generation routinely enjoyed. The mad fucking around, the hippie travelling, the drugs, the going off the rails, even the stonking idleness. You were also obliged to forgo the drinking. But then, you were hardly living with a good advertisement for the stuff. You didn't hold any of this against her, except perhaps the lack of drinking. Nor did you treat it as some unfair burden you were assuming. It was just the given of your relationship. And it has made you age, or mature, if not by the route normally taken. But as things begin to fray between you, and all your attempts to rescue her fail, you acknowledge something you haven't exactly been hiding from. Just didn't have time to notice. That the particular dynamic of your relationship is triggering your own version of panic and pandemonium. While you probably strike your friends at law college as affable and sane, if a little withheld,
What roils beneath your own surface is a mixture of groundless optimism and searing anxiety.
Your inner moods ebb and